Call this meeting to order. Let the record reflect, it is 2:05, April 5th, 2008. We have Representative Keller, Dugan, Gatto, Lynn, and myself. Also present are Senator Huggins and Senator Wagner and Representative from Fairbanks with the nicest sign in the world, Jay Ramirez. We do have a quorum. Today we're going to have an overview of the Alaska gas needs and market assessment. It's going to be done in coordination with the Science Applications International Corporation. Harold Hines is here to give us some public testimony. He's going to do the slide for us, I believe, right?
Yes.
Go ahead, Harold. Name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Harold Hines. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, a public corporation of the state of Alaska. We need to check at some point to make sure the consultants get online, because they're actually going to do the presentation. While we're kind of verifying whether they're online or not, and if you can give me the high sign at some point, just by way of background, this work is a result of the letter from the chairman to me about the middle of December, asking that we look at a fairly long list of issues related to the value-added in-state manufacturing based on natural gas and natural gas liquids. Basically, at that point, we looked around at how to get the work done, through a subsequent steps, we're able to engage a contractor, which I'll explain more about in a minute. Basically, the letter requested that we present the results of the study during the session. I apologize for the delays and times and sort of getting there, but today is a progress report, and that's the first thing I want to emphasize to you. The study is not complete, but I think there is a pretty good set of answers to a lot of the questions, at least, that were asked. More importantly, we consider at least some of the results noteworthy enough that you should be starting to ponder them almost immediately, even though the report is not finished.
And Harold, so we will be able to get a little bit more in-depth report if we come back into a special session and want to look at this from a 10,000-foot view again.
Yeah, our intention is to have a full report to you by the start of the special session, and also as part of the contract, the consultants will be available to come here and actually make the presentation physically at that time.
Thank you. And then we do have Senator Wilkowski. And Harold, is it going to work best for you if we just ask questions as we go along?
I think I've preconditioned the consultants to realize that they, as they sketch through this, you'll want to stop them occasionally. I think once we kind of get to the bottom line of this, I think more importantly at that point you probably will have a number of questions on it. I noticed Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we don't really have a start date for this special session quite yet, do you have a hard delivery date for the completed report?
I guess I had taken the governor's release the other day as June 3rd is what I was aiming at.
Okay.
I was taking that as the start, and basically what I was trying to offer was that if early in that session you wanted to schedule a presentation, we'd be happy to make those arrangements. And the contractors will be available for a presentation. That was the deal.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. My point is just that that start date is sort of up in the air still, I think.
June
3rd. That's fine. Thanks.
And Representative Dugan, if you've got questions, just always feel free to call.
Well, as I intend, Mr. Chair, the start date is June 3rd, but then the leadership is contemplating perhaps a pre-session.
Yes.
It'll be sometime before June 3rd.
Yes, as we've heard, Mr. Hines will try and have us to the June 3rd date. Go ahead, Harold.
Okay, thank you. The other part is just to, again, kind of set this up. As we looked around at how to answer the questions that had been raised by the chairman, it was pretty clear to me that rather than start from scratch, we would go back and look at a very high-quality study that was done in 2006. And it was done by SAIC under contract to the Department of Energy. And it was a very extensive study looking at a very wide variety of issues. But in particular, they did a very detailed and a very careful and very professional analysis of the potential industrial segments we might have here in Alaska, including value-added manufacturing. I contacted them, and we were able to subsequently arrange.
Do you have a name for SAIC?
What?
Representative Gatto?
A name for SAIC?
Yeah, again, they'll introduce themselves to you more, but Chris Ellsworth is the team leader, and scientific applications something, okay. Whatever. Yeah. They could tell you more about who they are, but as I remember, they have about 10,000 consultants. They do major work for the government on a large number of issues. I retain them to update their study. And up front, what I want to drive home to you is that the reason for doing this is that every time you pick up a new study, you end up with new personalities, new biases, new models, new assumptions, everything else. And so many things change on you, you never know what it means. In this case, we changed only one variable, which has to do with the energy price environment of the world today as it was back then. And that's why the study results, I think, are of great interest, is that this is a very professionally done job with one assumption different, basically. So, Chris, if you're online, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yes, I am, and good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Chris, could you please state your name, please?
My name is Chris Ellsworth. I'm with Science Applications International Corporation, and my position is Director of Energy Markets and Forecasting. Harold, I assume you're going to work the slides there.
Yes, and if you just occasionally tell me a slide number, I'll make sure I'm in sync with you.
Okay, great. We were contacted by ANGDA to perform an update to our 2006 natural gas needs assessment that was sponsored by the U.S. Department of Energy. And if you go to slide one, I'll just go over quickly the agenda that I intend to talk about, and that is to give you a little bit of background on this 2006 study, some of the study assumptions and methodology, some of those conclusions that we reached back in 2006, and then to talk about the preliminary findings from the update that we've been doing for the past month or so, and then a summary. If we go to slide two, the overall objectives of the 2006 study was to evaluate the feasibility of a spur pipeline off the main Alaska natural, or the proposed Alaska natural gas transmission system. And particularly that spur pipeline, it was to serve south central Alaska, the Anchorage, primarily the Anchorage region, but also into the Kenai Peninsula, particularly the Agrium fertilizer plant and the LNG terminal there. But we looked at four main sectors in that study: the residential, commercial, industry, which was broken into several segments, and power. And what we tried to do in this study was look at projected demand. Particularly for residential, commercial, that was a relatively straightforward task, and also for power, we ran a power model to look at potential gas demand from power. For industry, it was a little more difficult because we were kind of blue skying it. We were looking at industries that could potentially locate there that are not currently present. And within that, when we were looking at the industry, we looked at industries that could utilize North Slope gas to the maximum, and also the maximum feasible price that they could afford to pay and continue to operate profitably. And based on that analysis, we calculated a spur pipeline size, some costs and market storage requirements. And there was a follow-on study done by Arctic Slope Research Corporation, I think they're called ASRC, that took our demand estimates and our sizing of the pipeline and did a much more detailed costing and technical study of the pipeline. We also looked at Cook Inlet gas supply and the future of that, and that was headed, and that part of the work was headed by Dr. Charles Thomas of our Alaska or of our Anchorage office. The update that ANGDA asked us to perform is primarily to the industrial sector. So in this update, we're not looking at the residential, commercial, or power sectors.
Chris, while you're just there, I might interrupt. Just say that this is the full report he's referring to. It's over 100 pages long, and there's a lot of information on a lot of different pieces. We picked just that one part of it to update rather than to redo the rest of it, because we felt there probably weren't a lot of changes in the last 2 to 3 years in the other parts. But obviously, it could be done if somebody wished.
Thank you, Aaron.
Right. As part of the study, there was an advisory group formed, and the advisory group assisted us and also DOE in understanding and framing the issues within the South Central Alaska. They also assisted in obtaining data for the study and also provided a critical review of the approach, analysis, and results. And this is on slide 3. And to the right, you can see the members of that committee. And I won't go through them, but there were representatives from NSTAR, Fairbanks Natural Gas, Chugach Electric, and so on and so forth.
One of the reasons for having a steering group like that is that it does provide an element of peer review as the work is going on, and even no matter how competent the consultant, there may be things that they may not see. And through a peer group like this, there were several reviews of the work as it was in progress.
And Harold, who put this organization together? This group, who brought all this together?
This study was done under, I guess it's a bad word to use these days, an earmark of federal money that was sent through the Department of Energy to look at the background of Alaska gas needs and Alaska gas pipeline needs in Alaska itself. And as my understanding was that NSTAR certainly was one of the companies that played a major role in working with our congressional delegation, but the contracting and the funding and the direction of all the work was done by the Department of Energy through the National Energy Testing Lab, I believe.
Technology Labs, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll just go quickly over the methodology. We did a bottom-up approach to determine the level of sustainable natural gas demand from current uses, which is residential, commercial, and power, but also the new uses, which in this case we looked at a number of smaller industries, but in order to provide perhaps anchor customers to a pipeline, we primarily focused in on possible petrochemicals, expansion of LNG, and also gas to liquids was what it came down to. We also did an integrated market analysis. As you know, this was a spur pipeline off of ANGST, the Alaska Natural Gas Transmission System, and consequently, once that happened, then the price of gas in Alaska would become integrated with the price of gas in the lower 48 states. And so the price of gas that each industry would see would ultimately be determined by the price of gas in the lower 48 states. In summary, we were looking at current and potential uses of gas, what products they would produce, what markets they could sell those products into, and at what quantities. And also at what price they could sell those products into, and ultimately what price they could afford to pay for natural gas, and whether indeed it would work out or whether it would be profitable under expectations for natural gas prices in the lower 48 states and consequently Alaska. If we go to slide five,
Mr. Ellsworth,
I've mentioned this already.
Chris, Mr. Ellsworth?
Yes?
Mr. Ellsworth, when you were doing this, you said you looked at lower 48 gas markets and what we could do with Alaska's gas. Maybe while you're going through this, you could explain a little bit about what's already available in lower 48, what they may be doing with LNGs or any GTLs or NGLs, all of the above.
The lower 48, states right now, I would say, is in a relative gas shortage, perhaps since around about 2000, 2001. That's resulted in high gas prices, and consequently, I would say a relative boom, so to speak, in LNG imports and the building of LNG import terminals in the lower 48 states. It is also because of the increased need for natural gas in the lower 48. It has certainly reinvigorated interest in bringing gas from the North Slope to the lower 48. Does that answer your question more or less,
Fine. We can probably expand on it later. Thank you.
Okay.
And we will try to expand upon that in the final report to you.
Yeah. The industries we looked at were primarily LNG, and we looked at several varieties of that. One was to keep the LNG terminal at the Kenai Peninsula going. Another one was for an expansion of that facility, and then another one was for a greenfield LNG terminal, a much larger capacity. The other industry we looked at was gas to liquids, which is a relatively new technology, but with current global oil prices, it's become quite an attractive technology that a number of companies are pursuing worldwide. The other industry looked at was fertilizer, ammonia, urea. That was particular interest because of the Agrium plant. And then we looked at a host of smaller industries that I won't get into in this presentation, primarily because they provided only relatively small amounts of gas demand to underwrite a pipeline. We also looked at a world-class petrochemicals industry that primarily uses natural gas liquids rather than dry gas, as the other industries do. And then also developing greater use of propane using natural gas liquids. If we go to slide six, we have a summary from that report, that 2006 report of industrial capacity and gas requirements that were ultimately looked at. For gas to liquids, we sized a 50,000 barrel per day low sulfur diesel plant, and that had gas requirements of about 480 million cubic feet per day. LNG, we sized at 1.7 million tons per annum, which had gas requirements of about 212 million cubic feet per day. That is roughly the size of the current LNG export terminal. Fertilizer was 1.25 million tons per annum of ammonia, 1 million tons per annum of urea. And that, again, is roughly the size of the Agrium terminal, and that requirement is about 185 million cubic feet per day. LPG was sized at about 54,000 barrels per day of propane, requiring about 84 million cubic feet per day of gas equivalent. Petrochemicals was a 1.27 million tons per annum ethylene plant, requiring about 120 million cubic feet per day equivalent of ethane. to do now is go to slide 7 and show you and spend a little bit of time on this graphic, explaining to you the concept behind this graphic. What we have on the x-axis is the total quantity of gas or gas equivalent to natural gas liquids in million cubic feet per day. So what you're seeing in total there is the potential for almost a 1.3 BCF per day pipeline, spur pipeline, coming off of the main axis, which is quite a large pipeline, since the Alaska natural gas pipeline was sized at somewhere between 4.5 and 6 BCF per day. So it could be a quarter to a sixth of the size of that pipeline. On the y-axis, you have the what we could, is labeled value, but you could also think of that as the maximum price that each sector would be willing to pay for natural gas. For example, residential, commercial, will, we calculated would be willing to pay about $8.50 for gas before switching to some alternative fuel. Same with power; they would be willing to pay maybe a little over $5 a million BTU for gas. Again, before switching to some alternative fuel. With petrochemicals, then you're seeing about $4.50 or so per million BTU. And that's not so much switching to another fuel in this case, because power and residential commercial are kind of captive, if you like, within Alaska. The petrochemicals is based on the cost of building a plant and the revenue that they can expect from selling their product, transporting and selling their product overseas. And if they cannot make that revenue, obviously they're not going to invest in a plant. And so the maximum price we calculate they could afford to pay was about $4.50 or so a million BTU. And so you see on this graphic the approximate quantities that each industry is willing to pay, and the approximate quantities of gas each industry requires, and the maximum price that they are really willing to pay, and the fertilizer in this instance required some of the lowest cost gas.
And Chris, if you could hold on a second. Harold, is there anything before we go to the updated versions into the 08 findings that we should know about 06 or what studies have been here? Is there anything you want to add to that?
I think Chris and his team can offer you their conclusions, but I think if, as you look at this graph, what you see in 2006 was that while there was in Alaska a fairly firm market for maybe a growing power market, maybe up to 300 million cubic feet a day, everything else was kind of either at the cutting edge or underwater as far as the gas prices that were anticipated. So at least just looking at the industrial parts of it, the non-commercial residential heat and power, it was not a pretty picture at this point. That's, I think, the conclusion we all kind of drew from the graph when we looked at it.
That's right. And the reason it's not such a pretty picture is, of course, the market price in South Central Alaska is linked to the Henry Hub or lower 48 gas prices, which we based this forecast on the Energy Information Administration's forecast of gas prices published in their annual Energy Outlook. And essentially what we did was then, based on their forecast of lower 48 gas prices, we came up with a Chicago price and then backed off the tariff between Chicago and the North Slope, and then added the tariff back in to arrive at a price at the North Slope that producers could expect to get. And then assuming that producers will be indifferent whether they sell into South Central Alaska or the lower 48, as long as they get the same price, then adding a tariff back in to get the gas to South Central Alaska arrives at that price of between $4 and dollars a million BTU.
Now, you okay, Representative Dugan? And again, other legislators, we've got Representative Dallas is sick. We've got open seats here. Sir, welcome you to come up and ask questions. Go ahead, Harold. Go ahead, Mr. Ellsworth.
Slide 8 is just an introduction now. We're going to go into the preliminary findings for the 2008 update. And if we go to slide 9, it's similar to a previous slide we showed, but as Mr. Hines said, we are really focused in on industry, and again, it's LNG, GTL, fertilizer, ammonia, urea, petrochemicals, and propane, both of which use natural gas liquids. As was mentioned previously, our primary update is prices, which is particularly product prices around the globe, and natural gas feedstock prices that we could expect into South Central Alaska, again, expecting gas prices to be linked to the lower 48 states. But we also looked at capital costs, because capital costs have risen dramatically around the globe, as I'm sure you're aware of. And we also updated the units. Previously, everything was reported out in 2005 dollars. That is dollars adjusted for inflation. In this study, we're using 2007 dollars adjusted for inflation. And we're also looking at two price scenarios. One is what we're calling a low case, which is essentially natural gas and oil prices updated for forecasts produced by the Energy Information Administration. Again, that's part kind of an arm of the U.S. Department of Energy, published in their annual Energy Outlook 2008 reference case, and that is available at their website. But we also looked at a high case, which is perhaps more what the market is saying right now. And we based that off of natural gas and oil prices based on the recent futures strips. And if we go to slide 11, you can see the price of the Henry Hub for gas in the first row from the 2006 study that's been updated to $2,007 dollars. Then also the 2008, what we call in low case or reference case, which is about 627. But in our high case, based on the current future strip, we're looking at a price of more like 854 at the Henry Hub. That translates into a price in South Central Alaska, previously at about 481 in the 2006 study. We'd actually looked at the, we're now looking at the tariff as given on the, Trans-Canada, the new Trans-Canada proposal, and it looks to us like the tariff is a little lower than what was proposed previously into Alberta. Also, the prices between Alberta and Chicago seem to have changed somewhat. And consequently, you're getting actually a price now of about 406 in the low case, and about 618 in the high case into South Central Alaska. Oil prices in the previous study were expected to average about $47. Using EIA's AEO 2008, they estimate a oil price between about 2015 and 2030 of about $54 a barrel. And the futures market, when you look at that, that's looking more like around about $73 a barrel, and I'm sure you're all aware that oil prices are currently over $100 a barrel. One of the questions asked by Representative Newman was the cost of competing feedstocks, and it is, they are very low. When you look at gas prices in some other regions of the world that are developing GTL plants and are developing LNG terminals and things like that, the feedstock can be very low. That is the cost of producing it. You know, in the kind of 30 cents to 60 cent range, depending where you are. The other thing we wanted to update was product prices. And again, the world has changed quite dramatically in the past 2 years. LPG, and a lot of these estimates are based on expectations for oil and gas prices, as most of these products are priced off of oil and gas prices. But LPG has gone up from about $383 per ton to $639 and $834 in the high case. Japanese distillate has gone up from about $946 to $1137 in the low case, and almost $16 a million BTU in the high case. California LNG, and that is essentially based off of a lower 48 gas price adjusted for the market in California, the gas market in California, is gone up about a dollar from $5 to $6, and in the high case is about a little over $8. Now, Japanese LNG is interesting. In kind of a low case, if you like, or based off of our previous relationships, we were looking at prices very similar to California LNG. However, the LNG market in Asia is changing rather rapidly. The new markets are opening up in China, places like Singapore. That is, new LNG import terminals are being added in those markets. And it's putting a lot of upward pressure on prices. And recent long-term contracts to Japan, signed between Japan and Indonesia, have been reported in the greater than $16 per million BTU range. So Japanese LNG was traditionally priced off of East Asian crudes, and it was priced using the formula called the Japanese crude cocktail. And what is happening is market dynamics with the entry of China into the LNG market, the entry of India, the entry of Thailand and Singapore, places like that, are pushing up LNG prices much beyond their norms. And we've seen LNG prices in Japan recently upwards of $20 a million BTU. So again, you know, these numbers here are very preliminary. Price of ammonia has also gone up, and the price of polyethylene has also gone up.
Mr. Wells,
what does all this mean, Chris, in terms of profitability of plants? If you go to slide 13, you see an updated version.
Chris, Mr. Ellsworth?
Yeah, sure.
Where can you give us an idea of, we've seen the difference between 06 to 08. What if we were to go to 10? What do you think is going to be happening there? Can you give us your best guess there? You've talked about how a lot more countries are getting into that, but if, you know, well, even when Alaska hopefully gets a gas pipeline one of these days, maybe we can look at taking some of these other products or added value products and exporting them out of Alaska. Can you give us an effect of that?
Yeah, I think expectations are for prices to remain high, but perhaps not quite as high as they are right now. Certainly, the U.S. government in its forecasts expects prices to come off somewhat from their current highs. And also, many other market analysts are also expecting both oil and gas prices to come off their recent highs. However, there does seem to be, you know, a fundamental resource shortage around the, and when I say resource shortage, I mean energy shortage around the globe. It is becoming more and more difficult for the majors to find oil and gas, and that's primarily because they don't have access to the resources that they used to have. Most of the resources now are in state-controlled hands, you know, whether it be Saudi Arabia or increasingly in Russia or in other parts of the world, other major oil and gas producing parts of the world. And so the market, there's an expectation that the market can't respond like it used to with additional supply, or as much as it used to with additional supply. Also, you have the phenomenon, you know, over the past 10 or 20 years of India and China. You're talking about a quarter of the world's population that is showing very large demand growth, and you know, it's raising expectations. Prices are going to continue to be high, but there's been kind of a fundamental shift in global energy markets.
And Mr. Ellsworth, just to add into that, earlier we received information from Mr. Hines when they were discussing a 2 BCF line. A 2 BCF line having approximately 90,000 barrels of gas liquids in there, 50,000 of that propane. Mm-hmm. This committee, the EDT committee, had meetings with the consulates from China, Japan, and Taiwan, or Korea, I guess it was. It was their comments that they would take up all of that, plus more, anything that they could get out of there, because China's taking anything extra in those LNGs, or at least the propanes, as far as the world's concerned. Is that how you feel on that?
Yes, I do. And it's interesting that they've said that to you. And, you know, what, of course, these are very large projects and they're very, very risky. So, but if you have long-term arrangements underlying these projects with Taiwan, Japan, and other countries, then, of course, much of the risk of the projects could be passed along to those customers.
Did you want to add to that, Harold?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll do it briefly. I agree with what Chris said. I attended a fairly major international conference a couple of months ago, and basically oil demand is projected strong for at least a decade or more because of China, India, and other people like that. Oil supplies unable to keep up with demand growth, high prices as a result of that, just an inability of the industry to mobilize all the resources it takes to find and develop and produce oil on a continuing increasing basis. The gas market on an international basis expected to restructure, but the dynamics of it very slowly, a couple decades maybe, for the restructuring to a world gas market. And all those kind of things I think are consistent with what we see today, even though it may not hold for every year out into the future. We're going to certainly revisit over the next 10 or 20 years the scenario today more than once in that 10 or 20 years. So,
thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Ellsworth.
Thank you. So on slide 13, what we have here is similar to the graphic previously, but in this instance, particularly if you throw in recent prices of Japanese LNG, and actually this is these prices represent about $12 or so a million BTU, results in a required gas price, if you like, or feedstock price in Alaska around about $8 or so, $8.50 or so a million BTU. Now, if you look at West Coast LNG, that is, although gas markets are certainly in short supply in the lower 48, given forecasts for natural gas prices, the required gas price, if it was to head to the West Coast, is much lower. around about $4, or the maximum, I should say, the maximum gas price that an LNG terminal could pay for South Central gas. Propane looks very good based on recent market prices for propane. Interestingly enough, the fertilizer looks very good because of the increase in urea and ammonia prices. That again seems to be driven by the Asian markets. And interestingly enough, there's speculation also that a lot of it's being driven by the move to ethanol and the growing of crops for fuel rather than food. Then also petrochemicals look good, or they're certainly in the upper band of expected prices in South Central Alaska. The one that is still highly uncertain is gas to liquids, and that's primarily, I would say, because the technology is still somewhat unfounded. It's still a relatively the plants going in right now are still relatively experimental. They've got plants going in Nigeria and Qatar and places like that. And so that one is a little bit less certain. But since we did the study back in 2006, the capital costs on a barrel per day basis have risen almost doubled, from about $20,000 or $22,000 per barrel to over $50,000 per barrel. And I've seen estimates even higher than that. So I think the technology there goes a little bit against that.
Mr. Ellsworth, if Alaska was able to attract a company that was willing to do GTLs in-state, what would the price of gas have to be to make that economically viable if those were produced and so and used in-state?
Well, what we're showing here is a price of around about $350 is required in Alaska to really make GTLs viable.
Mr. Chairman, the other issue is that the work they've done here, each of these bars represents, you might say, a world-scale facility. And obviously you could do more than a world scale sometimes on some of these things. But in the case, I think, of the question you're asking, you'd have to look more at the specifics of how big is that plant and how much economies of scale are you achieving by restricting yourself to the local market. But if you had both a local market and an export market, of course, then you could probably proceed along the lines of what they've outlined here.
And for the record,
so this represents a 50,000 barrel per day plant, which is actually quite a large plant for GTLs. There's, in other parts of the world, they've been sized at 20 to 30,000 barrels per day.
Right.
And
I would say.
Excuse me, Mr. Ellsworth, but we have been joined by Representative Gardner and Senator Theriault. Thank you.
Thank you. If we go to that's the low price scenario. If we go to the high price scenario, where natural gas prices in South Central Alaska essentially rise from the $4.50 to $5.50 range to about the $5.50 to or $5.80 to $6.80 range, we also have product prices going up also, because again all these products are related to oil and gas prices, and there you see kind of the maximum price that could be paid in this. So essentially what's happened here is, although with natural gas prices rising in the lower 48 resulting in higher gas prices in South Central Alaska, the rise in global energy prices has resulted in product prices that make Alaska much more attractive.
Mr. Chairman, again, it's the potential that's illustrated on these two charts that I saw about a week and a half ago that kind of led us to be with a little urgency to get in front of you, because the 2006 study indicated maybe an industrial value-added demand of 100 million cubic feet a day. This is not any residential commercial on here, so you're seeing a half a billion to a billion cubic feet a day of potential value-added manufacturing here in Alaska. And that's a significant sea change in terms of the size and importance of the opportunity.
And that's exactly why I asked Harold to do this, and we started this discussion last fall, is to, you know, we're going into discussions on a natural gas pipeline, is what can we do with Alaska's gas? Is it just all going to be exported down through Canada, or what can we do in Alaska? I know Senator Wagner's been working on that quite a bit, trying to expand on those opportunities, but it's also been one of my highest priorities of what can we do with Alaska's gas besides send it all out of this state. Go ahead, Harold.
Chris, if we could just move through the other slides here to the conclusions.
Sure. I think we've already talked about some of this. This is the markets for the products, and you know, we modeled these marketplaces. That's on slide 15. Slide 16 is a preliminary estimate of gross revenues in millions of dollars per year. We're looking at the potential between about 4.7 and almost $6 billion if all these industries were to come to fruition.
And as I remember, the investment number for these kind of plants would be comparable numbers to that, in the range of $5 billion, give or take.
I seem to remember that was so. We will detail that in the report.
Right. And we'll also highlight the employment, but it's obviously measured in thousands of jobs.
Yeah.
Well, when we're looking at this gross value on this, too, you know, each one of these companies who may want to get involved in this, they have their own risk assessments that they want to go through. How does that compare if they're doing this inside of Alaska as compared to outside of Alaska and such?
Well, you know, it's interesting when you're looking at global companies. You know, obviously, when you look at the price of gas in the Middle East and West Africa, and you look at the price of gas that will probably occur in South Central Alaska, South Central Alaska is going to be higher. So, from a purely economic point of view, it doesn't look as great. However, you know, and Alaska will probably be the high cost producer. However, when you're a major global petrochemical company or LNG company, then Alaska, although Alaska may be one of the highest cost producers, it can still be profitable. And also, it provides a degree of political stability and also access to markets, both on the West Coast and in Asia, that you'd be hard-pressed to find in some of these other parts of the world. So, so I think companies, large companies, will be looking at from a global portfolio point of view. That is, Alaska will be one of the more expensive places to locate, but it will also be one of the safest places to locate.
Representative Mr. Ellsworth, Representative Gatto had a question.
Yeah, Mr. Ellsworth, I think I heard you throw out a $5 billion number for a plant, but I'm curious, are we talking about the gas treatment plant at the source? We're talking about the LNG plant? We're talking about the GTL plant? Or are they all the same?
Different capital costs. I don't have the capital cost numbers in front of me, but I can certainly send them to you. The capital costs that are associated with each of these technologies.
Representative Gatto, let me see if I can explain. I introduced the confusion about a number that we don't have a chart for. We had constructed a similar chart for this, just based on some ballpark estimates of how much investment. An LBG plant, for instance, probably would require very little investment. A GTL certainly would probably weigh in at over $1 billion, maybe probably approaching two. And the only point I was making was if you built all these plants, it was probably a number that looked like $5 billion for one each of all these plants, just to give you a feel for the size of an industry you're talking about. The other part is that as to this question of why Alaska, one of the things we find as we talk to people is, especially if you're like in the petrochemical business, you're in the manufacturing business, your biggest problem in the world right now is access to gas, because the national oil and gas companies, the five mega major oil companies, have pretty well cut up the world at this point. And if you're a Dow or you're somebody like that, it's hard to find opportunities to build a major plant. And that is one of the reasons these companies all, at some level, will look at Alaska if we have available these kind of supplies and if they visualize the kind of price world that we're talking about here.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Ellsworth.
On to the last slide now, which is the summary of our preliminary findings. That we really do find that the increase in product prices have changed the feasibility of options for natural gas use. Whereas previously, LNG and fertilizer projects really didn't look very good. Given recent markets in or recent price trends in Asia, both look much better now. Again, as I mentioned, high and uncertain capital costs and technology make GTL perhaps the most questionable. However, we are looking. The period of time we're looking at is 2015 to 2035. Within the next 8 to 10 years, a number of GTL plants are going to be coming online around the world. And so it is my expectation that through learning, the capital costs for GTL plants will decline. And so that would have to be kind of reevaluated. We believe that higher energy and product prices do enhance the feasibility of gas-intensive industries in South Central Alaska over what we found before. However, as someone mentioned previously, the investment climate will remain highly uncertain given the ongoing volatility in energy product prices. But I think if you're, and it sounds like you are already talking to potential customers, then I think if you have customers that can enter into significant contracts for the products that these industries will produce, then it will reduce that uncertainty considerably.
Chris, just one of the questions that's in the room on the theme of what you just said is, if you had a name, what's the top five prospects for companies that might be interested in doing something like this in Alaska? Could you run through just a short list of names?
Would be interested in petrochemicals. They are currently in the Alberta market, and their feedstocks are declining there. So they are potentially looking for a new area to locate where they have access to natural gas liquids. On LNG, of course, you currently have ConocoPhillips there, but any one of the majors, either U.S.-based majors or some of the European majors, such as Suez, could be interested. On the gas to liquids, that technology, Shell and BP have both been active in developing that technology. Another one is Sasol out of South Africa, who has also been very instrumental in this technology and actually has been active in Qatar, providing their expertise to the building of GTL plants over there. Is that sufficient for the moment?
We'll pick your brain offline sometime.
Sure.
Here I am back.
Representative Dugan and then Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dow in Alberta, are they just buying gas there or are they processing petrochemicals there?
Processing petrochemicals.
So...
Natural gas production is in decline there, and so is natural gas liquids production in decline there. So over the long term, I think they have to look for potentially another place to locate. When we did the original study in 2006, we had quite extensive discussions with Dow, with engineers there, when we were trying to price out the potential cost of a petrochemical plant in Alaska. And they didn't sound adverse to Alaska under the right circumstances, because they're already used to paying a relatively high price for their natural gas liquids in Canada.
Representative Dugan?
So would it be timing issues if we're talking about, as we are at the moment, running a spur line to South Central off of a larger pipeline that would take the most of the gas to Canada, wouldn't Dow just wait till our gas got there and process it in the facilities that it's already got?
Yeah, they could very well do so.
Yeah.
Although Alaska, it's a calculation they have to do, because Alaska actually gives them greater access to world markets, so they may find that there's a greater value to selling petrochemicals to Asia rather than internally within Canada or the U.S. It's a calculation they would have to go through.
Okay. Access like at Point McKinsey. Senator Wagner.
My question is has to do with gas to liquids, and if you have GTLs, and the world's going more and more toward the green concept, and because of the cleanliness of which that burns, what is going to be the value in the future, in the near future, for GTLs in areas such as Southern California and some of the larger metropolitan areas up and down the seaboard on the East Coast versus its current current market value? Isn't that going to increase tremendously? I know California is talking now about increasing taxes even now.
I would imagine so. GTLs is equivalent really to an ultra-low sulfur diesel. The standards within California and along the West Coast and in other parts of the U.S., they're tending towards mandating a greater use of ultra-low sulfur diesel, which would, and again, it's relatively short supply. It's quite expensive for refiners to gear up to produce that diesel. So it will tend to drive the price up. As to how much is difficult to say. What we've found in doing this update is actually the premium between Japan and the West Coast has actually been increasing. That is, the Japanese have been willing to pay 30 cents or so more per gallon for ultra-low sulfur diesel than the West Coast. And that's, they face their own issues with pollution. Over time, we'd expect that differential perhaps to equalize somewhat. But again, that kind of shows that the ultra low sulfur diesel or GTLs are probably going to be in relatively short supply compared to demand for at least the foreseeable future.
Thank you,
Representative Gatto.
Now, Mr. Ellsworth, is there a demand for GTL since ultra-low sulfur diesel is available anyway?
Well, yes, there is, because generally because of the greater emphasis being placed around the globe on clean burning fuels. So to go back to something the demand is going to be there because it's primarily being mandated by governments. And it is relatively expensive to produce, and some refiners probably find it prohibitively expensive to upgrade their refineries to produce it, given perhaps the age or the characteristics of their refinery. There should be a role for these GTL plants in supplying that fuel.
And again, that, you know, by the federal government is requiring by 2010 the use of these low-sulfur diesels. And the synthetic NGLs, basically a synthetic fuel with virtually no carbons, you know, or very little carbons in them.
Yeah.
They're mixing those with current diesels or petro products to try and come up with that blend. So it's a mix of the both. Representative Gatto?
Yeah, Mr. Ellsworth, considering that we have the Trans-Alaska pipeline in place and mostly empty, then would it make more sense for us to take our gas, don't worry about building a steel pipeline all the way to Alberta, just don't build any pipeline, just build a GTL plant and ship the liquids in the existing pipe along with the existing oil? A million barrels a day is the capacity. That's easy. We probably have closer to 1.5 million barrels a day capacity. Is that an alternative, or you wouldn't want to do that because economically it doesn't make any sense?
Well, I don't know whether economically it doesn't make any sense. It is much more expensive to run a GTL plant at the North Slope. We actually priced that out in the 2006 study. That was a thought to place a GTL plant there. We haven't redone the economics on that, but we were estimating a capital cost that was maybe 30% higher than if one were located at Anchorage. So the economics are interesting as given the increase in capital costs and the likely increase in operating costs, whether you're better transporting the gas down to Anchorage and converting it into liquids, or doing it at the North Slope and using the taps.
Representative Gatto, we have tried to be pretty careful so far in addressing this issue sort of from an Alaskan level. We haven't really talked about where some of these things are. Obviously, the visualization is Cook Inlet in many ways, but it doesn't mean that other places wouldn't work at all. We don't have any reason to that. But we haven't really attempted to drive the study in that direction to try to understand those differences yet. That would be a more sophisticated look at it. Suffice it to say that we found these results encouraging enough that it begs to go on and start to answer some of those other questions and try to understand some of those things. For instance, it might be setting the stage for some sort of very clean hydrocarbon line separate coming off the North Slope. And again, whether you think of that as a small gas line or a small clean hydrocarbon line or whatever, those opportunities may be very attractive to Alaska. Again, especially the NGL issue you raised of NGLs to Canada, the visualization in this study is that you would basically straddle the big line and you would extract disproportionately some of the NGLs and use them here in Alaska. If you had a small line from the North Slope, you could potentially capture the NGLs right there at the source in a separate form, keep them separate, and keep control of them here in Alaska. And we haven't even started to sort out all those implications yet, sir.
Harold, could you address several years ago when Mark Meyer was still the director of oil and gas, I asked him, Mark, what's the feasibility of trying to get gas to Southeast? If we had a pipeline built today, trying to get a spur line, he said it just is not economically viable yet. Now with Agrium going down, peak usage at 480 million cubic feet a day as opposed to 600, do you think that trying to attract any added value type of industries into the state make it more feasible to try and get a spur line to South Central, or can it stand on its own, whether it's a bullet line? Just talk about that a little bit.
Well, again, I backed up to slide 7. I mean, again, this was sort of the relationship of value and volume and everything in 2006 study. And it's a reasonable portrayal. What it shows is an in-state market at those price assumptions that maybe is in the 300 to 400 million cubic feet a day range. And if you kind of think about the investments that would be required to hook things up and just kind of ballpark it, it might work at that volume, but it's got to be close to the edge. And then if you fast forward, though, to these kind of numbers, and you start to think about, I got 300 in already in the residential commercial market, and now I'm looking to add a half a billion to a billion to that, that dramatically changes your view of the possibility. And again, I can't say that we've thought of all the implications of that, but no matter how you see the pipeline system working, delivering in Alaska, you've got to leave yourself the ability, we think, for this to happen. And that means a high-pressure gas line of some size that makes sense in terms of these kind of numbers.
And that's always just been my thought, and it's Representative Dugan.
It's still looking a little tricky, isn't it?
even if it was easy, you wouldn't need us.
even at these prices, you're at, if you add in the other three, you're at about 800, right? Million cubic feet a day, roughly something less than a B. And you're counting on some significant additional industrial capacity being built to be able to have the market for some of this product, some of these cubic feet. And it's not entirely clear that even if you got that, you're talking about 1 B a day, say, that you're going to be able to build a pipeline that delivers the gas cheaply enough, considering the tariff, to be able to attract these, right? So, I mean, we're still several steps back from having a really good idea of whether this is feasible, aren't we?
Representative Dugan, I think you're just right on. That's why it's labeled preliminary findings, right. And let's call it draft preliminary findings.
Well, we just want to run right out and build something. Yeah, so
nobody is going to build based on these economics. Yeah. On the other hand, what we are showing you here today should at least raise the flag that you don't want to lightly pass up the opportunity for an in-state industrial market that might represent a half a billion to a billion. For instance, let me take the counterpoint to what you said, which is you were right on. The presumption here of 200 billion or 200 million a day into an LNG plant is premised on the plant that exists. That number might be much bigger if you make it two or three times bigger, for instance. And those kind of possibilities are there, and we're just not in a position to say how it all plays, but we all of a sudden went from a case where the industrial contribution to help paying the bill for the citizens, basically heating and lighting their house, it went from being a small number to a big number. And I assure you the kind of numbers we're talking about here in terms of the bill you pay is two or three times better. And that's the significance from our point of view. Now, how it gets captured, how those people make those investments, they're not going to make investments based on this analysis, but it does tell us we maybe need to keep beating the bush. We need to go find those industrial people and see what their interests are. The chairman of my board and myself made a trip to Japan a couple, 3 years ago on the propane issue alone, and I will tell you that those people would do anything to have access to that level of propane. And they would make the investments in the, you know, snap of a finger.
The one thing that we're really missing here is a degree of confidence in our ability to project gas prices over time, I think, because what looks good on paper, as far as I know, there's no way to rate whether we're going to be in this price environment, the one we have up now, whether we're going to revert to something more like the 2000, the price environment that the 2006 study was based on, or if, in fact, the price environment's going to improve, relatively speaking, for Alaska gas, because the more expensive the rest of the gas is, the better we look by comparison. Is there, are you involved in or aware of sort of any attempt to, insofar as it's possible, perfect predictions of gas pricing far enough into the future to be able to make these kinds of decisions?
I'll try, okay? Number one, it is absolutely certain and predictable that we can't predict the prices, okay? That's one of the rules. On the other hand, it seems fairly clear the type of price world we're talking about here, now that it has occurred, the reasonable question becomes what's its longevity, what's its reasonable probability of reoccurrence? Those kind of questions can be asked. And that's not all discouraging. Again, if you visualize prices go from very, very low numbers to very, very high numbers, that scares you a little bit. But if you're going to visit some different worlds and they're not that far apart, that's not so scary. The key part of what we're trying to show you here is all that investment, all that capability is based on long-term commitments. These are not people that are going to buy a 20-year supply of gas and pay a vacillating day-to-day Henry Hub price. These are people who are going to make a long-term commitment and, in essence, buy the equivalent of reserves in the ground. They're going to fix a price, and it's going to make sense to them in terms of it. For instance, if you look at the Agrium situation, it made sense when the people who owned the plant owned the reserves. When Agrium bought that plant, the urea plant, they unfortunately did not buy the reserves, and that turned out to be their Achilles heel. In this case, what we're trying to describe here is a situation where you have the long-term commitment and you probably strike some longer-term price relationship that guarantees that you can compete in the bigger picture over the longer term. Is it still at risk? Absolutely. And is it still hard? Yes. But again, that's why you go ask the industrial guys what they're thinking. And that's why, again, you got to go to the other end of the spectrum and talk to the people who control the gas and find out what their willingness is. Fortunately, as you heard the list of people that are involved in this game, some of them also are people who, for instance, already have reserves on the North Slope of Alaska.
You know, several very important things that I just took out of what you just said, Harold, is the fact that something that we've heard over and over again, including from the guy sitting in the back there with the nice haircut, is, you know,
should I turn around and look at that?
Mr. Porter, you know, the need for the state to try and come up with some long-term stability for industry. And if we're going to be able to try and attract industry in this state, if we're going to try and get a gas pipeline built, in my opinion, we're going to have to try and do something like that. But it's critical. We've heard that over and over again. And I think that's what Mr. Ellsworth was counting on when they did this study. Am I correct in that, Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But in some ways, we're sort of like a guy who's trying to hitch a ride on a comet. You know, we aren't really a very important part of the comet, and we don't know where it's going, how fast it's going, or how high it's going to get. You know, my concern about this, I mean, I suppose if the numbers actually, if there was confidence that the numbers were going to stay something like this, that we wouldn't have to do anything but sit here and applaud while people signed contracts, you know, to buy gas and turn all this stuff out. But my concern about it is, if it's not, what are we going to do when people who've got half-built plants come to us because we're the only flex in the equation and say, oh, by the way, we don't want to pay gas taxes anymore? You know, I mean, that's why the question about the price environment to me is so significant, because we've seen this in the oil patch forever, right? Is that what's flexible for the people who produce oil is Alaska taxes. I don't expect that to be any different if it becomes a gas patch than it is now, you know. So it's going to, I mean, you've got to have some considerable amount of confidence that the price regimen's going to be more like the high case over an extended period of time for this to look like a real prospect, I think. Am I reading that correctly?
Again, I think you're drawing attention to exactly the right fact, which is the big pipe is going to be built based on long-term commitments, big commitments. And so are these plants and all the other relationships. And again, the only way I can kind of, the reason I kind of laugh a little is if we have the audacity to think we can develop a proper environment for a $30 billion pipeline, what are you scared about with a $5 billion industry that actually employs lots of people here, produces taxable revenue, is part of our local tax bases and all those other things? And if you kind of look at the trade-offs here, to the extent that we have the audacity to think we can solve the other problem, I think we can solve this one too, is all I would say. But you're right, the devil is in the details, and again, we have to be willing to approach this stuff with that attitude of what does it take to really make it work? And it's going to take different things with different players in this thing. Dow is not going to look at this the same as a BP or a Shell, for instance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And again, any other legislators? Wilkowski, Terrio? Okay, anything else you want to add to this, Harold?
Well, again, I appreciate the opportunity here today, especially up against the NCAA tournament. Your patience with me. We get to watch the second half, I hope, here. I didn't catch the score yet, but I'm sure we will. I appreciate the opportunity because when it gets time for the special session, whenever that is, there are going to be a lot of important considerations. And certainly the in-state issues are not going to drive your decisions. I understand that. But for instance, this at least gives you some data point to start to think about the in-state industry, the opportunity. How do we make sure we not foreclose that either inadvertently or by limiting something or whatever? And that's all I would ask is that we keep the positive attitude of how to keep this option open and working forward.
And again, that's just something that I'd like to echo too to my friends in the legislature. Let's keep this door open when we're talking about these discussions. Thank you. And with that, I guess nobody else has any other questions. We will close out today.
Thank you.
It's 3:25.
Good job. Thank you.